health is wealth, and this is where we're going to talk about it. The Small Conversations for a Better World podcast with hosts Jillian McCormick and Susanna Steers. This podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and or their guests to the show. The content is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as medical advice nor established legal standard of care.
We gratefully acknowledge that the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast is created on the ancestral, traditional, asserted, and unceded territory of the Coast Salish nations, including the territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and the Musqueam.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Small Conversations for a Better World podcast. I'm Susanna Steers.
And I'm Jillian McCormick. This week on the podcast, we will continue our discussion of learnings from the Indigenous Canada course created by the Faculty of First Nations at the University of Alberta. If you're tuning in for the first time, please understand that our conversation today, while it could likely stand alone, is the continuation of our Season 5 mission to better understand the history of the relationship between settlers and Indigenous people in Canada. Our purpose in this mission is to be able to engage in meaningful conversations about race, trauma, and decolonization practices through a better understanding of what really happened. To that end, please head on back to the beginning of the season and start there, as formative events and concepts have already been covered. If you are interested and truly wish to better your understanding, then head on into the Coursera.org website and take the free Indigenous Canada course along with us. So today's conversation will cover module 6 of the course to provide a framework to what the course calls the modern Indian. I'll point out that the title ends with a question mark. The modern Indian? Like that. We'll cover the span of time between the late 1800s until, well, now, as it relates to Indigenous economics, the impacts of changing and expanding resource management in Canada, and the changing gender roles imparted by the settler culture on traditional Indigenous practices. Our conversation today will cover a wide range of topics, distances, and timelines to bring us into this uneasy present.
The places where people settle is determined in large part to where they can provide for themselves and for their families. This might mean, where can you farm or ranch successfully, or where can you get a job that will pay you? If you've been following along, you know that, indeed, the economic lives of the Indigenous people have changed in the last 150 years due to the changing landscape brought about by the settlers. And by landscape, we mean literal, ecological landscape, as well as political, legal, and cultural landscape. As the traditional forms of economy and the fur trade began to fade, more and more Indigenous began to find forms of work that were wage-based. What they did for this wage depended upon where they were geographically and what natural resources were around. Some certainly turned to farming and ranching. This sixth module begins with the First Nations and Métis on the Plains. I was interested to hear about how the Plains Métis women were always significantly involved in the financial health of their families. During the early hunting times, they would make the pemmican. When the bison robes became popular, these women would prepare ropes for transport and for market. They then adapted traditional skills to find new ways to thrive in the changing times. They took advantage of government policies like Métis scrip or homesteading, and the equipment, land, and money for seed that came with that. Those who could bought land and farmed or ranched, while still others ran trading posts. They collected bison bones left out on the plains and chopped wood for the settlers living on the land. These settlers formed towns out there on the prairie, and this further opened up opportunities for Métis women, working in the hotels and the restaurants, as laundresses, as seamstresses. Meanwhile, hunting and trapping continued to bring in some money, as well as the traditional skills of beading, sewing, hooking rugs, making moccasin, gauntlets, and other clothing items. These items represented a vast array of designs, colors, and skills. I really get a picture of these resourceful women just trying to find ways to support the family and community while their worlds change around them.
When it comes to the new Indigenous farmers, so they were given the land, some tools, and some instruction as negotiated in the treaties. We should all take a moment to guess how this went down. There would be one Indian agent responsible for huge tracts of land and multiple farming people. These people were new to the craft and to the tools. the advice that they were given from the Indian agents was not adequate. This impacted yields, along with the expected droughts and weather events that everyone is familiar with if you've ever paid attention to the news on the prairies. When the yields did get better, then the settler farmers in direct competition complained to the government, and actions were taken as follows. Restrictions were placed on Aboriginal farmers, dictating the price that they could sell their goods for, to whom they could sell their goods, and perhaps most importantly, when they could sell their goods. Not all areas of Canada, of course, are suitable for farming. And in these regions, there were other industries formed, which were also influenced by the infrastructure being built further and further north. For instance, in the early 1900s, the fur trade was revitalized for a little while. The telegraph allowed communication directly to the north, which created one of the first ways around the monopoly of the Hudson's Bay Company. There were different and advancing transportation technologies. And between 1920 to 1930, the northern regions further opened to the expansion of the fur industry as the railway began to move north. Steamboat services began to expand in the Mackenzie and the Athabasca districts, and bush pilots began offering service to the north. Furs were reaching markets even faster, and this brought in new competition in the form of different companies looking for furs. For a time, this was beneficial for the Indigenous trappers, and they could receive a good price for furs. That didn't last forever. Some of Canada's first efforts in conservation actually began around 1930. And this is a key moment, as these were the first attempts made to define hunting for subsistence and hunting for commercial purposes. The RCMP were given the task of monitoring how many trappers or hunters were harvesting, in essence, deciding where and when the Indigenous were allowed to hunt. Out on the West Coast, the fisheries were picking up, and Indigenous folks were involved in the development of these industries. Women worked in the canneries. Men fished the ocean as labor for commercial fishing operations. Again there began to appear regulations that would limit the types of equipment that could be used and when harvesting could occur. Fishing license further divided fishing into commercial and subsistence fishing. There have been decades of opposition to restrictions and licensures, and eventually that opposition paid off when the Supreme Court of Canada ruled in favor of Aboriginal rights to fish. These stories make me think of the many times in my life when I've heard news stories that covered the disagreements in the fishing industry between settler fisheries and Indigenous fisheries. As recently as 2020, there was a lot of unrest in Nova Scotia when local Indigenous began a self-regulated lobster fishery. This was on the back of a Supreme Court decision in 1999 that allowed for Indigenous to build such a fishery for the purpose of making what they called a moderate livelihood, what the Supreme Court called a moderate livelihood. As far as I understand, they were offering licenses to Indigenous lobster fishermen that were outside the Department of Fisheries and Oceans recognized lobster season. Of course, they were met with non-Indigenous fishermen acting aggressively towards them. But more troubling to them was the lack of government action to support their Aboriginal rights to fish. It appears to be the message and practice again and again through history. The government says one thing, but their actions are another. Or they act one way, but is recorded says another. A lack of transparency and integrity might be the best way to identify this trend.
Which brings us to resource extraction, a major Canadian enterprise that has been seen as an inevitably destructive force at odds with cultural practices of Indigenous communities. Gillian, I was really interested to learn that while this notion may certainly be true, there are communities that are willing to engage with resource extraction as long as cultural sustainability practices are respected, and that the environmental impacts don't impact traditional land use, such as fishing and hunting. I read this to mean that if your mine might leave a tailing pond that leaches chemicals into the surrounding land and water, thereby creating toxic environments for fish and animals, there can be no mine. If your mine has already done this, you'd best clean up the neighborhood in whatever ways possible. We all know when it comes to this, that an ounce of prevention is certainly worth a pound of cure. This conversation is one that highlights the principles that this podcast has uncovered again and again through the past four seasons of talking to experts and researchers and clinicians and business owners. There are no silos, and everything impacts everything else when we're discussing health. The health of our planet, our natural environment influences the food and the water that we put in our bodies to nourish our bodies so that they may be healthy. Efforts in this vein produced what is recognized as the first modern land claims agreement. The James Bay Project involves a hydroelectric project on La Grande River in northern Quebec, championed by the Hydro-Québec Corporation and the Quebec government. These two proponents of the project did not consider Indigenous land use patterns when they conceived and indeed began the huge hydro project. I remember hearing so much about this as a kid. A lot of the controversy surrounded the environmental impacts of flooding over 10,000 square kilometers. There was mercury poisoning of the fish in the area related to this project, which was toxic both to the fish and to other organisms that ate the toxic fish, including people. Other threats to the Indigenous way of life created by the project included changes to the natural landscape, a decline in wetland productivity, changes to the temperature and natural seasonal flow of the pattern of rivers, and disruption of animal migration routes. Once announced, the Cree opposed the mine. After some shenanigans where the government of Quebec did not want to negotiate with the Cree, eventually everyone sat down and negotiated a deal called the James Bay and Northern Quebec Agreement, which, as noted, is our first modern treaty. It was amended at one point to include another Indigenous people, the Naskapi First Nation in Northern Quebec. The Indigenous did benefit from this agreement, including a plan for economic growth in Northern Quebec and social, cultural, and governmental institutions for the James Bay Cree. I really credit the course for mentioning this example of an agreement related to the resource extraction in Canada that actually had some benefit for Indigenous people. Typically, resource extraction comes with negative impacts that are felt by the most marginalized communities of people. And one such community are the women of the North, the Inuit women that live near the mines. Apparently, these women often experience increased rates of unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted illnesses due to the high prevalence of prostitution that caters to the miners.
Now, Sue, certainly in this day and age, we can name so many Indigenous opposition efforts against resource extraction projects. We'll just name a couple of them here. For example, in 2020, along with the coronavirus, we also learned a lot and heard a lot of ongoing stories of the resistance of the Wet'suwet'en peoples against the construction of the Coastal GasLink pipeline through 190 kilometers of their unceded territory. In 2021, we watched as 882 protesters were arrested, making Ferry Creek blockades the biggest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history. And these protesters were against the logging of 1,000-year-old trees on Vancouver Island. The number of arrests made it larger than even the Clayquot Sound action of the 1990s. There are countless examples of these actions by Indigenous, and it seems that this is because companies target the lands of the Indigenous, perhaps without consultation and certainly without showing the level of respect for the protection of the natural world and animals and waterways of those areas in question that the Indigenous would most value. But sometimes I wonder how come it's always Indigenous communities, and or is it that it happens in non-Indigenous communities too, but we don't tend to stand up for the environment. We just let the project happen. Not that we feel good about it, right? A lot of us sometimes don't feel good about it, but we let it happen. We're not as perhaps blockade-minded, you know? I'm not sure kind of where I want to go with that or what I'm thinking, but I just, it's just again and again the examples of the Indigenous saying, hey, no, actually, we're not going to stand for that.
Well, if we go back to the discussions that we had about Indigenous economies and even worldviews, judicial worldviews, educational worldviews, for Indigenous peoples, these are all tied to the land and the responsibilities to each other. The colonizing mindset is all about the dollar. Like, how are we going to get money to make this happen and increase our own wealth? So a lot of the time it's, I think, damn the torpedoes full speed ahead, regardless of what's going on and what damage we may cause. And I think it's relatively recently that we're starting to have opposition, or more opposition, shall I say, perhaps as evidence of climate crisis is stacking up. maybe we're starting to recognize that we're not doing ourselves any favors. Settler community, anyway, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you must be right about that. It's development over everything else. Mm-hmm. It's the most, you know, lauded and somehow important value. Most protected value is that of development. We will take a left turn now to discuss the impact of westernization upon the traditional gender roles of the indigenous. So when it came to the men, there were different emerging avenues for masculine and cultural expression. Like, for instance, rodeo. Rodeo was a place where indigenous men found community. Despite an ongoing colonial presence, they did have to prove their status to compete. These were arenas, however, where there was family, there was a connection to animals, there was a place of shared experience that wasn't just about the indigenous struggle, nor was it blatantly political. So there was community found in the rodeo. Another area of culture where indigenous men showed up was the military. When it came to World War I, 4,000 indigenous men enlisted, though the population of the indigenous in Canada was only around 100,000. Enlisting came with some benefits, like a steady wage, some travel and adventure and meals. And they did enlist for the lifestyle, also maybe because friends and family had also enlisted. And some went to honor their relationship between themselves and the British Crown. They went to help the British fight the war. When the war ended in 1918, the downside began. Veterans' files were run through Indian Affairs and not the typical veteran pathway. The Ministry of Indian Affairs could not fund all these returning soldiers. Frustrated with the lack of support on their return, the League of Indians was formed. And this represented an early effort at pan-Indian organizing, which I take to mean an organization for all the indigenous in the country, regardless of their community of birth. We've talked a lot about how there's a ton of different dialects and different kinds of indigenous people, different tribes. And so this was pan-Indian, just to help any indigenous come together. It was to assure the protection of Aboriginal rights. And because of that, its work was directly opposing the Indian Act. So the government actually worked to suppress the actions of the League of Indians, which is why I think it wasn't extremely well known. After the Second World War, another organization was created called the North American Indian Brotherhood. And it is taught that their efforts were also suppressed by the government. I don't really know what this means. What did the government do to suppress them? I don't know what it means. It wasn't talked about what that means. But I think the gist is this was, I think, appropriate opposition to the way that Indian affairs were being handled, and Indian affairs didn't like it and so suppressed it.
They shut it down. Remember that some indigenous cultures were matriarchal. Women had been responsible for food gathering, making of tools, and rearing of children. Now they took jobs of wage labor on farms and in cities. The first generation of women graduating from residential schools took domestic jobs that they had been trained for in the residential schools. A colleague in medicine expressed that the women were healers, having knowledge of herbs for healing and other healing practices. There was a status for women that came with this knowledge keeping that was lost as their legal, political, and community structures were changed. Aboriginal women were the first to leave the reservation to the settler communities in large numbers. This was due in part to enfranchisement. Enfranchisement was the act of becoming Canadian. To do this, an Indigenous person had to give up their Indian status. That meant, in essence, that all the supports and privileges that came with status, both monetary and in the forms of services, such as they were, disappeared. Women, however, would be forcibly enfranchised if they married a non-Indian. So they immediately lost their Indian status. It meant losing their band membership. So they lost their family of origin and their community when they agreed to marry someone who wasn't Indigenous, who wasn't a status Indigenous person. And this enfranchisement was passed to their children too. They were unable, and I mean, according to the law, unable to live on the reservation. And they couldn't be buried beside their ancestors or take part in traditional ceremonies. At the very same time, Indigenous men who married non-status and even non-Indigenous women actually regained their status and gave their Indian status to these non-Indigenous women. The policy was certainly misogynist and definitely racist. The enfranchisement that would strip a woman of her Indian status privileges would also happen if she owned property, voted, or became a professional like a lawyer or a doctor. Women's movement advocates began talking about this in around 1959. And it wasn't until 1985. Think about that for a second. 1985. That's like I graduated high school in 1985. It wasn't until then that non-status Indigenous women were given their status back and their children gained status for the first time. So along with these forces that would push a woman into the city, there were also forces that pulled. Education opportunities, for instance. The healthcare sector began to train Indigenous women as nurses and other healthcare practitioners. I know you think this is cool and great, but these opportunities often came with barbs. They were not able to get positions within their own communities. So great to have the training, nice to be able to have a job. The government of Canada would retain control by having settler nurses on the reservation. Interestingly, the beauty industry was a place an Indigenous woman might find a welcoming environment, fully supported by Indian Affairs. In fact, the marketing photos for these schools would show Indigenous women working on non-Indigenous clients, one of the few places where there was diversity shown. This was an industry where the quality of education would not suffer for the Indigenous women. And in beauty, the industry of comparison, there was a place of equal opportunity and inclusion.
We'll round this episode out talking more about education. Education was one of those means of pulling the Indigenous off reserve. However, the Indigenous are quite adept at using this westernized settler institution of education to the betterment of their own people. Integrated education off the reservation is criticized as having no real inclusion of Indigenous content or methods of education. On-reservation issues are not exactly less, as reservation schools are not funded as well as off-res schools to allow for development of the curriculum or provide Indigenous content to all students, especially Indigenous students. There are exceptions to this rule. Examples include, for instance, a school in Edmonton, Alberta. It's called the Amiskwasi Academy, a school for grades 7 to 12 dedicated to Indigenous content, Indigenous identity for Indigenous students with Indigenous staff. These schools are not yet the rule, but it sounds like, along with healthcare, education is a place where there is much development currently. Post-secondary opportunities for Indigenous people were very limited initially, as their residential school experiences didn't prepare them adequately for post-secondary opportunities. There were, of course, exceptions to the rule, and some did pursue post-secondary. There are even post-secondary institutions entirely for the Indigenous, like University Blue Quills in St. Paul's, Alberta, or the First Nations University of Canada in Regina, Saskatchewan. This has led to Indigenous professionals, of which, of course, came along with the threat of enfranchisement. And that's a concept I hadn't ever thought about before this course, that becoming Canadian is a threat to their indigeneity. And personally, this thought shames me, Sue.
Yeah.
I would love for the First Peoples of this land to want to become Canadian. But when they did want to, this meant that they had to give up their families and their cultural identity.
Give up everything.
Give up everything. We think that we're a mixing pot in Canada. That is what I was taught, that all cultures were welcome and that they could keep their own identity within the Canadian national identity. But I think that my Indigenous classmates were learning was that there was room for all identities except for theirs. You could be Indo-Canadian, Japanese-Canadian, Chinese-Canadian, but you could not be Indian-Canadian. I digress. In these times of 2022, I have no doubt that a post-secondary education is a good thing to the Indigenous, and they are educating themselves right along with the colonizers, and they are taking that knowledge back to their communities, and they are raising them up. I also hope that there are some just getting educated and living in the cities and working and living peacefully along with us. But I don't know that that is true. I don't know any Indigenous people in my immediate community. Now, they may have an Indigenous background that isn't visually apparent and they haven't shared with me. That could be true. But I haven't known anyone like that for a really long time. When I left my hometown to pursue my post-secondary education, they just weren't around me anymore. And I guess I'm starting to understand why. I want to take a moment before we round out this episode to talk about a deep dive I did into the work of an individual called Ibram X. Kendi. He is a scholar and an activist whose work is to teach out about and to call out racist policy. He has an excellent book out there. It's called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And it basically points out that if any policy is written to exclude or marginalize another population, it is a racist policy. The regulations around, say, crop yields that work to eliminate any direct competition between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal farmers, that was a racist policy. The policies, as Susanna pointed out, about Indigenous women losing their status and their rights to live on the reservation when they married someone who was non-Indian, was clearly a racist policy. Very, very true that it was also extremely misogynist. These policies did not originate with the Indigenous. They came from settler culture. And I think it's a really important thing that we as settlers acknowledge where the patriarchy has come from. And we have to acknowledge when we see racist policy. It's all around us all the time. And we cannot hope to be a not racist society unless we change those policies.
And have the courage to stand up and call it out for what it is.
And call it out for what it is. Agreed. And it does take courage to speak up like that. There's been so many examples of it in the last few years of people calling out racist policy and standing up. And I hope there's more. I hope it continues. I hope I'm brave enough at the moments that I need to stand up and call it out.
Me too. Okay, folks, we're going to leave it there for today. That's all for our small conversation today. And we'll be here next time.
And we'll have the coffee on.
If you liked what you heard, we encourage you to head on over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. Better yet, subscribe and leave a review. That really helps to make it easier for others to find us, to help broaden this small conversation.